So today we're going to talk about never in a million years calendar and holiday myths. These are just some of many myths that that we can speak about when it comes to our observance of Shabbos and Yom Tov and various times throughout the year. The first myth we're going to discuss tonight is the following. It is customary for a woman to wave her hands and cover her eyes before lighting Shabbos candles. Now, the truth is, reading this now, I probably could have phrased this a little better. There is no question that it is customary for a woman to do that. I guess that's not a myth. The question is, you know, what source, if any, can we find for this custom, and can we make sense of it? So when thinking about the mitzvah of Hadlakas Neros, which is a very special mitzvah, one which is typically, although not always and certainly not exclusively, fulfilled and performed by women, but women usually have the opportunity to light candles on behalf of the other members of the household. So there's a special ceremony, if you will, that we are accustomed to, which involves, as these pictures all depict in some way, shape, or form, the woman moving her hands, waving either to her or from her as part of the process of the mitzvah of Hadlakas Neros Shabbos. And the question is, what is the source for this? What's it all about, and how can we make sense of it? So it's actually very fascinating, the halachic background to this practice. The Shulchan Aruch in Aruch Chaim Siman Reish Simach Gimel says, "Kishayalik, when a person lights Ner Shabbos, Yivarech. The bracha that is recited is Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher Kedushanu B'Mitzvosav V'Tzivanu Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbos. Echad Ha'ish VeEchad HaIsha." This is true if a man is lighting the candles, if a woman is lighting candles. This is the bracha that is recited. Now the Ramah, in his comments on the Shulchan Aruch, right there writes, there's a machlokes as to whether or not the bracha should be recited before or after one lights the candles. Yesh misha omer shemevarchin kodem hadlaka. And why should that be? Well, that's not the exception. That's the norm. Typically, whenever we do a mitzvah, we recite a bracha beforehand. The bracha is recited over lasiyasan as the lashon of the Gemara before we do the mitzvah. However, says the Ramah, quoting the Mordechai, yesh misha omer shemevarch achar hadlaka. There are those that say that when it comes to this mitzvah, the bracha should be recited after the performance of the mitzvah, namely after the kindling of the flame. And the question is why? So the Ramah doesn't explain this over here, but the reason would be because there's a concern that maybe with the recitation of the bracha, the woman has accepted upon herself the Kedusha of Shabbos. And once she says, Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbos, so then she has now accepted upon herself all of Shabbos, including all of the restrictions and limitations of Shabbos, and she's no longer able to light the candles. So how do we, in a sense, do the lighting first, followed by the bracha, but sort of preserve the integrity of this concept of overlas yasun, which means the bracha comes first. Ukadeshi overlas yaso lo yen mimena ad lachar bracha. The compromise is that the woman should not derive benefit from the candles until after the bracha. Umasiman ayad lufnei haner achar adlaka umevarchin. And so therefore the hands are placed opposite the candles in order to sort of block the light, and then the bracha is recited. And afterwards, hayad, and this is now called v'chena minhag. And this is the minhag, says the Ramah, quoting the Maharil. Now it's important to note that in this regard, there may actually be a difference between a man and a woman. According to most Ashkenazic customs, if a man lights candles, actually he recite the bracha first and then light it, because it is not assumed that with the recitation of the bracha, there is automatically a Kabbalah Shabbos and acceptance of Shabbos. When a woman lights the candles, generally we assume, and a t'nai could be made, but generally speaking, that's not what happens. A woman recites the bracha and accepts upon herself the Kedusha of Shabbos immediately, so therefore she would light the candles first and make the bracha afterwards. Now the Aruch HaShulchan has a slightly different version of this custom. He says, "Lachen madlikos kol haneros," the candles should be lit. Woman should cover her eyes. Right? Doesn't say anything about covering the candle, but rather she should cover her eyes. Sort of accomplishes the same thing, because if your eyes are closed, they're covered, then you're also not benefiting from the light. The Sefer Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa quotes from the Menucha Shlema that actually the right way to do it, the proper way to do it, is to cover the candles, not your eyes, And he specifically goes out of his way to say that covering your eyes is not the right way to do it. I'm not sure that I understand why. I read this several times. It wasn't clear to me why, because it would seem that they both sort of accomplish the same thing, unless the idea is that if you cover your eyes, that's very nice for you, but still, you know, the light is sort of spreading, and over here when you cover the candles, you know, maybe you're sort of limiting the spread of that light. It's not clear. The Kav HaChaim mentions something very interesting. He says, "Masim al yad lifnei haner." Right? What did the Rambam say? You should put your hands opposite the candle. V'maneros rabim. If there are many candles, she'ein dai b'hasamas hayad. So it's not enough to cover it because, Baruch Hashem, there are so many candles burning. So then, tatzum eineha. So then she should close her eyes and make the bracha v'achar kach. Tiftach eineha v'tenam and ha'ar kadesh v'yeval asiyasun. So the Kav HaChaim says it may depend how many candles you're lighting, whether it's sufficient to go ahead and cover like this or actually cover your eyes. Now, in the Piskei Tshuvos, which we've quoted from several times over the last couple of weeks, he says, V'yesh anagos, there are those who have the custom, l'hakif haneros, three times to sort of wave, to rotate one's hands, b'yadeyem kodem kisei apana, before covering the face. V'lo matzino l'zeh makor, we have not found a source for this. But he says, we found a source if someone says to do it. Quotes from the Sefer, Tzon Yosef HaKadmon, this is actually, as you can see over here, somewhat of an old source that this is brought down, but we don't know the reason. And actually, Piskei Tshuva says l'chor gam griusi yesh bazeh. It may actually be a bad idea. Why? Ki ayidei akafa chayeves l'staka b'neiros. When a woman goes like this, so while she's doing this, she's looking at the candles. And what we saw in the Rama is that you should really cover your eyes immediately in order to make sure you don't get any hana. But nevertheless, and this is so beautiful and really appropriate, and it's for this reason I didn't begin with my disclaimer tonight, because here's my disclaimer. And this is such an important message as we continue to pretend that we are really busting myths. Some are, but some are really very, very ancient and hug him. He says, the truth of the matter is, we don't have any source for this. He says, Amnan al-Kagonda, regarding this we quote, and he quotes from the Tshuvas Heshev Moshe, Ein litchos kabbalah shebiyad anashim azkenos mibnei amenu. We should never go ahead and just push away a custom that we find among our, he says, specifically elder women, but in other words, people who remember seeing from the mothers and the grandmothers, maybe the great-grandmothers. Shishim ribo mofsim. Even if you find, using this as a figure of speech, 600,000 different mofsim, different wondrous miracles, hamarim hofcho, which go ahead and seem to indicate that this is wrong and the opposite. No, kichocha yisraeli hu lemalam yateva v'aseichem. The bottom line is, Jewish law, Jewish tradition is something that sometimes transcends logic, it transcends reason, and just because we don't know why we do things, we shouldn't just stop them. So, the fact is, there is no basis for the practice of waving one's hands before the candles, but don't stop doing it. Now, after I went to print today, I found something very exciting, and I was really excited about this because I was actually thinking maybe this is where it came from. I found in the Sefer Minhag Yisrael Torah, beautiful set of Svarim, so he writes as this. He says, "Lefi Anir," he says, "it would seem the Minhag Zanimshach that this custom sort of came from the Kav HaChaim." Remember, the Kav HaChaim said before, "It depends how many candles you have." It says the Maneiros Rabim Shlo Yistaka B'Chol Ayad. You can't cover it with your hand, so then you should close your eyes. First, they want to cover the nair, the candles, but since there are so many candles, they wanted what to cover their eyes, and so therefore, the custom sort of evolved that they sort of do a little of everything, right? Go like this, and then move it, try to cover all the candles. Can you imagine? You have a lot of candles, and first she's trying to like cover all of them, and then afterwards she goes like this. It's a beautiful explanation. It would seem very likely to me, especially since, like I said, I thought of it, and then I found it, and maybe that's where it comes from, which sort of, it's very nice, because if it's true, it highlights the fact that some of our customs have really evolved from a very deep integrity and desire to preserve the integrity, fidelity to the halachos. And so therefore, you know, the Rama says, cover the candles. But others say, you should cover your eyes. So people want to do everything. So you want to do everything, you end up doing things that look a little different, and before you know it, people are waving their hands. Okay, next myth. One should preferably recite his own Kiddush rather than be Yotze by listening to another. So the Pasuk says, we just read this a couple of weeks ago, Zachor es yom haShabbos l'kadsho, that we should remember Shabbos, we should mention Shabbos, and the Gemara in Pesachim Daf Kuv Vav tells us, Tan Rabbanon, Zachor es yom haShabbos l'kadsho, Zachrei olayayin. that from here we see that there's a mitzvah to go ahead and to mention Shabbos, to state Shabbos, to declare the Kedusha of Shabbos al HaKos. That's what we know is the mitzvah of Kiddush. Now we know that often Kiddush is recited by one individual. How do you do that? After all, everybody has their own obligation to recite Kiddush. So how does one person recite for many? So there's a Talmudic principle known as Shomeya Ka'one, which means that whenever we have a mitzvah where something needs to be recited, so it is acceptable for one person to say it and have in mind to be what we call motzi, which means have a mind to enable other people to discharge their obligation, and then those who are listening and have proper kavana can be yotze. So you can think of other examples where we have this concept. There's no mitzvah to hear the Megillah. There's no mitzvah. The mitzvah is to read the Megillah. The bracha we say is Asher Kacham Mitzvahnu Al Nikra Megillah. But in 2 weeks when we're going to hear the Megillah, we're fulfilling our obligation through the process known as Shomea Ka'one. I've heard it, and it's like I said it. So that's what happens when it comes to Kiddush. But the question that we're dealing with tonight is, you have two people standing together. This is sort of a common scene. It goes on at my Shabbos table all the time, although my wife is usually one to initiate a question. Would you like to make your own Kiddush? She says to our guests, would anybody like to make their own Kiddush? But the question is, why are we offering that? Maybe we're just doing it to be nice. You know, maybe people like making their own Kiddush. But from a halachic perspective, what would be preferred? So what are the two sides? So one side to say is there's a concept of mitzvah bo yosem yibishlucha. Now, in all fairness, and I put a little star there just to say that some would argue maybe this rule doesn't apply over here, but there definitely is a Talmudic concept that when you could do something yourself, it's better to do it yourself than delegate it to somebody else. Mitzvah bo yosem yibishlucha. So one of the famous examples that the Talmud gives is when it comes to, let's say, getting ready for Shabbos. It's true that I could hire somebody to clean my entire house. And there's nothing wrong with hiring somebody to help me clean my house. However, just to go ahead and to give that to somebody else, so I'm missing out on the opportunity to engage in the what? In the mitzvah of Kavod Shabbos by myself. Mitzvah bo, yosem yibishlucha. On the other hand, there's a concept which I believe we mentioned in one of the earlier lectures. Berov am hadras melech. This is a pasuk. That what? When we have the opportunity to go ahead and to do a mitzvah in a united way, it's a greater hither, it's a greater sign of kavod to the Shekhinah to be able to add and do it as a collective body, as an assembly, rather than doing it as separate individuals. So what should we say when it comes to a situation like this? On the one hand, everybody should make their own kiddush, right? Mitzvah bo yosem b'shlucho. On the other hand, Barov ha-majos melech. So comes along the Mishnah Berurah, and he paskins for us, says the Mishnah Berurah, kosva poskim. And kama noshim osim mitzvah achas, if you have people who are doing a mitzvah together, mitzvah l'chachila, she'echad yivarech l'kulam, the berov am hadras melech. It is proper that one person should recite, in this case, let's say the Kiddush, and everybody will fulfill the obligation together. Now, if that's not your own personal custom, then you should not deviate from your own personal custom. There are definitely different opinions when it comes to this. But I'm addressing this not only because it's something that I see often, but I have a feeling that some people may be under the impression that it's better to do it yourself, because that's just sort of our natural way of thinking. Why have somebody else make Kiddush for me? I could do it myself. Isn't that better? So it says in Mishnah Berurah, actually, no, it's not. Better would be one Kiddush and everybody has the opportunity to join together. So the fact is,
what about Kriya Shema by Marav? Kriya Shema is an obligation.
The very good question. So why do we say by Kriya Shema, you have one person say? So when it comes to davening, and when it comes to Kriya Shema, when it comes to the recitation of brachos, generally speaking, we say that everybody should do it for themselves, because tefillah, obviously, it's a personal initiative. Shema is Kabbalah Somachu Shemayim. And if somebody was not able to daven, either somebody doesn't know the words, or somebody's not comfortable davening, or physically not able, so then there's what to talk about. So there are exceptions. There are times where we say, no, you should do it yourself. And there are some the other notable examples. But generally speaking, when it comes to a mitzvah, that requires speech, so then we apply this principle of Shemei Ka'one. So all things being equal, one person should recite Kiddush on behalf of all others present. Okay, next myth. A woman may not recite Havdalah. Now, again, in many homes, I would probably say most homes, where Baruch Hashem, it's a family, it's a husband and a wife, so Minhag Yisrael is that a husband makes Havdalah and Kiddush also on behalf of the other members of the household. But that's not always the case. Sometimes the husband is away. Sometimes the husband's not there. Sometimes there is no husband. Sometimes the only person who's there is one woman or several women. And some are under the impression that a woman may not recite Havdalah. Now, where does this come from? So if you look in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Reish Sadivav, The Mechaber teaches Nashim Chayavos b'Havdala, Kishem Shachayavos b'Kiddush. Women are obligated in Havdala, just as women are obligated in Kiddush. V'yesh mishacholik, but there are those who disagree. There are those who disagree about Havdala, not Kiddush. Why? What are the two sides? So the Mishmaru explains the two sides. Let's start deal with the first position, the one that says women are obligated. Even though it's a mitzvah saseh shezman grama, it's a positive time-bound mitzvah, and women typically are exempt from having to fulfill such mitzvahs. However, the bedina Shabbos, ish v'isha shavin. When it comes to the laws of Shabbos, men and women are equal. The iskash zachar l'shamar, because of the hekesh we find in the Gemara between zachar and shamar, right? Anybody who is required to observe the restrictions of Shabbos is also obligated to perform the mitzvahs of Shabbos, which include, let's say, Kiddush. According to the opinion, it says Havdalah is from the Torah. Havdalah is really the opposite. It's like the other bookend of Kiddush. We begin and we end Shabbos by praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what? For creating Shabbos, for sanctifying this day. And even according to the opinion that says Havdalah is the Rabbanon, still we would say it's similar. So says the Bishop, that's why you would say that a woman is obligated in Havdalah. Why would you say that maybe she's exempt? When do we say Havdalah? We don't say it on Shabbos. We say it during the week, right? After all, Shabbos is already over, so now it's not in a tluya bin yanei dini Shabbos. Shar mitzvah says zman grama denashim peturos. It's like any other mitzvah. Says she says zman grama. Woman is not obligated. So the Shulchan Aruch brings down two opinions. Now, of course, a woman should always assume. Like the first opinion, which is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, that in fact she is obligated, and make every effort to hear Havdalah. Says Rama, Al Kain lo yavila li atzman, rak yishma Havdalah min anashim. Says Rama, since there's a question as to whether women are obligated, the best thing to do would be to hear from a man. This way, if she's obligated, she satisfies her obligation. If she's not, so she doesn't have to be concerned about what. So that's already another, that's beyond the discussion right now. About what? She's going to say what? She'll say, it's not going to be a bracha levatallah, right? The minog of all Ashkenazic women is that a woman would recite, let's say, a bracha on a lulav and a shofar and sitting in a sukkah, even though technically she's not obligated. So why should this be any different? So it's very interesting technical reasons to why this may be different. The order of the brachos, you say the bar priya guffin, and then, okay. So, but the bottom line is, the Ramah suggests, and this is not a matter of dispute, in the Ashkenazi community, a woman preferably should hear from a man. But what if she can't? Again, what if it's not that easy if there's no man around? The Aruch HaShulchan says, V'ra'isi misha hiksha de'echav yavdilu, comes along the Aruch HaShulchan says, wait a second. So the Aruch HaShulchan makes a big case that in fact a woman can and should make Havdalah if there's no man. And he says there are those who say, no, she shouldn't, because women can't drink from the coast of Havdalah. He says, for Tamane, I didn't understand this. That's not a din that a woman can't drink from a kosher Havdalah. Not everybody's concerned about this. And therefore it's very clear that when she does make Havdalah, she can drink from the cup of wine. And so the bottom line is, the fact is that a woman may recite Havdalah. Again, in many situations, the question doesn't come up. And there are times where a woman chooses anyway, even if a woman, let's say, lives alone, she chooses to hear Havdalah from a man. And of course, that's a choice that can be respected and should be respected. However, technically, according to the law, a woman may recite Havdalah. The next myth, looking at the hands of the Kohanim when they are duchening can lead to blindness. Well, I'll tell you, when I heard that as a kid, I didn't laugh as you just did. I guess we're older now, so we can talk about this with a clear mind, level-headed people. So, where does this myth come from? So this myth actually has real sources. As we'll see, the Gemara in Chagiga tells us, Darash Rabbi Yehuda b'Rav Nachmani, kolam estakel b'shlosha devarim, einav kehos. Excuse me, I accidentally deleted a letter there. Anybody who looks at three things, it will affect one's eyesight. It doesn't say that you'll be blind, but your eyes will get weaker, dimmer. One of them is Kohanim, says the Gemara. I'm stachdav Kohanim mitzvash Beis Hamikdash Kayim. One who would stare at the Kohanim when the Beis Hamikdash was in existence. Sheyo omdim al duchanim when they were standing on the platform. Umevarchan es Yisrael b'shem ha-mefurash. And they would bless the people using the b'shem ha-mefurash, the special name of Hashem. So if a person would look, it would affect one's eyesight. Rashi says why? Shashchina shora al kishrei etzboseyim. Because the Shechina, the divine presence, would connect itself, would be present at the place of the fingers of the Kohanim, And if a person would stare, it would be like almost lahavda, like staring at the sun. Staring at the sun is something to be harmful to the eyes. So here's a beautiful illustration of what that may have looked like, with the Kohanim standing on the platform, blessing the people, standing in the Azara. So if a person would look there, says the Gemara, Bizman Shabbos HaMikdash Kayam, so this would affect one's eyesight. The Gemara Megillah says, Reb Shuvan Levi, Yada Bukanios La Yisas Kapov, says Reb Shuvan Levi Alocha, that if you have a Kohen who has either deformed fingers or discolored fingers, he has something's wrong with his fingers, so, or his hands, he shouldn't do Nesias Kapayim, he shouldn't lift his hands and do the Duchen. Now why? What's the problem? So Rashi says, because since he looks different, since his fingers are different, and people will be curious, people are going to stare at it. And the Gemara Chagiga says, you shouldn't look at Kohanim when they're Duchening, again, because it's bad for your eyes. So Rashi says, that's why Shimon Levi says, if the Kohen has something wrong with his hands, he shouldn't Duchen, because the very curious people are going to be looking and staring at his hands, and it's bad for their eyes. Tosfos says, that can't be, because Gemara says, this is only what? This is only Bizman Shemesh HaMikdash Kayim. But now we're talking about outside the Beis HaMikdash. We're talking about here in Teaneck, New Jersey. It doesn't happen every day. Eretz Yisrael, they duchen every day, but wherever, even in Eretz Yisrael. The duchening we do today is not the duchening b'shem ha-mafurash. It's not in the Beis HaMikdash. So what's the concern? Therefore, it's a different problem. The problem is Hesach Hadas, right? The question is, I couldn't find a better picture for this. So we know what Hesach Hadas means. Hesach Hadas means it's going to be distracting. People are going to look up and they'll say, oh, look at his hands, oi, oi. And it's going to distract them from what? It's going to distract them from what they're supposed to be doing. It says in Shulchan Aruch, B'shasha Kohanim Mevarchim Es'am, when the Kohanim are duchening, Lo Yabitu V'lo Yasichu Daitam, a person should not stare and he shouldn't get distracted. Yuei Neim Klapi Mata, Kamosha Omei B'tfila. A person should look downwards, as what a person does when he davens. V'am Yichavnu Levracha, the people should listen carefully, intently to the bracha. They should be facing the Kohanim in that direction. You should have your back to the Kohanim, but you shouldn't stare. Says the Mishnah Berurah, Vimkein Kol Shekein L'Shol Yistak Magmacher. Certainly goes true, you shouldn't be looking elsewhere. Medina Eino Aser El Vistaklis Meruba. And anyway, says the Mishnah Berurah, the only problem is staring. Sheyachol Lovely Dei Hasachadas. This is something that could lead to a distraction of a Re'ik Tzah Shari, but looking a little bit is fine. And then he says, and anyway, this whole thing is only Bizman Shebeis HaMikdash Kayim. It's only when the Beis HaMikdash was standing. Now, you still shouldn't look at the Kohanim. You shouldn't stare. It's okay to glance. You shouldn't stare. Why? This is what he calls a Zecher LeMikdash. This is a way for us to sort of preserve and remember the way it was in the Mikdash. In the Mikdash, we didn't look at the Kohanim. Now, remember today, often the Kohanim actually cover themselves, as do the people very often, during the Berachas Kohanim, which serves as sort of a double protection. You can't really see the Kohanim when they're under the talus anyway. Another question, what the Kohanim is supposed to be looking at. Kohanim, they're also not supposed to look at their fingers. But the Kohen's under the talus, and everybody's looking. All you can see is hands, you know, which are covered by a talus. So, bottom line is, today, anyway, doesn't really lend itself so much. By the way, once we're talking about this, where did this come from? Right? You can't really talk about mitzvahs and Birchas Kohanim without addressing this one. So what do you say? Is it true or not? Absolutely it's true. Here's a quote. So I'm with my father, my grandfather, and my brother sitting in the bench seats. Women were upstairs. Five or six guys get up on the bima of the stage facing the congregation. They get their talits over their heads and they start this chanting. And my father says to me, don't look. So everyone's got their eyes covered with their hands on the talits over the faces, and I hear the strange sound coming from them. They're not singers. It's also our shul also. They were shouters and dissonant. It was also discordant. It was chewing. I thought something major is happening here. So I peeked and I saw them with their hands stuck out from beneath the talit like this. Wow. Something really got hold of me. I had no idea what was going on, but the sound of it and the look of it was magical. So says Leonard Nimoy. So that's true. It's not a myth. That's where it comes from. Okay. Bottom line is, looking at the hands of the Kohanim during Duchening today, anyway, will not affect one's vision. That's an important condition today, because again, Bizman Shemesh Mikdash Kayim, B'mehera Yibana Mikdash, so when the Kohanim will be able to do the Berachos Kohanim, B'duchanan, so at that point, we will once again be careful not to look. Okay, myth. One must thoroughly clean every room in one's home before Pesach. So, this is an important one. We find ourselves now about 6 weeks or so before Pesach. So this is just about the right time to address this. You know? I mean, you know it's only going to get better from here because this is the myth. This isn't the this is the myth. So what's the truth? So let's first start. There are very good reasons to be concerned about the Isser of Chametz in Pesach. The last thing I want to do is stand before you and tell you, Chametz, the whole thing's overrated, it's not a big deal, it's just a minig, it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you can't have Chametz. It's not true. There are actually very good reasons that we should be a little anxious about Chametz. I'll list some of them, this is not all of them. First of all, when it comes to Chametz and Pesach, there's not just a prohibition of eating Chametz, there's a prohibition of deriving benefit from Chametz, which would include, let's say, feeding pets. That's not the only example. And even owning Chametz is a prohibition on Pesach known as the Yisur by Rabbi Yimatzen. So, from the get-go, we see that when it comes to Chametz, we're not just dealing with eating, but we're dealing with the prohibition of deriving benefit and owning Chametz. These are all Torah prohibitions. These are all Isir Deraisa. In addition, when it comes to Chametz on Pesach, if one would eat Chametz on Pesach intentionally, so it carries with it an onesh of kares. We're not going to talk about right now what kares is. It's not clear what kares is, but we know one thing. Kares is very bad. The Torah it tells us that eating Chametz on Pesach is a terrible sin, and therefore it carries with it a penalty which is reserved for the worst sins that we find in the Torah. So that's something that we cannot and should not deny. Another important feature of Chametz is, as Chazal tell us, lobedile inshimine, which means people are not accustomed to separating themselves from Chametz. All throughout the year, we have our routine, which very often includes, you know, buying Chametz in the morning, eating Chametz in the morning, waking up in the middle of the night, eating Chametz. Listen, we just have a Chametz around us all the time. So all of a sudden, just go ahead and shut it down for 8 days and just completely, you know, retrain myself not to look, eat, touch, smell. So that's very hard. As opposed to somebody who's a observant Jew and knows that, you know, you don't eat a cheeseburger. You can wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, here's a cheeseburger, and say, I can't eat it. But third night of Pesach, you know, a guy wakes up in the morning, he's hungry, and goes downstairs and he has a donut in the Lobadili in Shemineh. And finally, at least as far as I want to mention right now, there's no bittul on Pesach, meaning normally if a little milk goes into the chalent, so we know, yes, you always have to ask a question, but in many situations like that, after the fact, we're going to say it's okay. In theory, and hopefully this is only theoretical, in theory, if you'd have one little crumb of chametz, which would fall into a big, big, big pot on Pesach, before Pesach is a different question, so then we would not allow for bittul. So you can have one little crumb that would force you to go ahead and have to throw out, let's say, an entire huge pot. I don't care how big it is, it doesn't make a difference. There's no bittul, afilu be'elef, says the Gemara, which means even more than that. So, definitely, there are good reasons to be concerned about the use of Chametz on Pesach. However, let's just think about this. We prepare for Pesach with a pretty simple, rather simple ceremony. It's a mitzvah. I shouldn't call it a ceremony. It's called Bedika Chametz and Bittul Chametz. And if we do that properly, it essentially relieves us of any concern about Rabbi Yimatzeh. In other words, you know where your Chametz is. You've got rid of it. You put it aside. You sold it. So what's really the worst case scenario over here? Let's just think about it. You absolutely have to keep your kitchen clean and your dining room clean and the kitchen clean and the wherever people are going to eat and prepare food fine. But once you go into the other rooms of the house, let's just look at this, a typical house over here. So I'm going to throw some bread all over the place. I got a big loaf of bread over there, over there, everywhere except the kitchen and the dining room. So what? So what's the concern? So first of all, obviously, that's a big loaf of bread. You're not going to have one in your bathroom. You're not going to have. But let's just say that there's some Cheerios, let's just say under the refrigerator. You know, let's be really risky. Not under somebody's bed or in the vents. Let's say it's under the refrigerator. So what? You're not going to eat it. You're not going to find it. You're not going to see it. So it's there. It may not even be edible at that point, but even if it's edible, even if it rolled under there just a couple of days ago, that's why you said a bittul chametz. There's no issur by Rabbi Matzeh. First of all, in order to violate the issur by Rabbi Matzeh, it would have to be a certain size. It's not going to be that size anyway. So the bottom line is, you really, really don't have to go ahead and completely and thoroughly clean your entire home. There's a beautiful article which I've shared with my shul in the past from Shlomo Aviner called How to Do Your Pesach Cleaning Cheerfully in Less Than One Day. And here are some of my favorite quotes from that article. Educating children, if you want to do spring cleaning, this is certainly possible, but not before Pesach. It's not the appropriate time. Pesach vacation. I guess he's probably talking to an Israeli community where they have off from school already for a week or two before Pesach. Bein Hazmanim. That's a great time to take trips, playing with the kids, being happy, dancing, and preparing stories for the Seder. We do not have anything against house cleaning, but you should spread out over the course of the year. Each few months, clean another room. This is not the time for projects of cleaning and arranging. In any event, when the Seder arrives, there'll still be disorder and cleaning that has not been completed. Question, he says, does a husband have to help his wife? Answer, no. A husband does not have to help his wife, nor does a wife have to help her husband. Rather, the two of them have to clean together, since it's a shared home, and there's a shared life as well. Summary, he writes, in light of what is written above, it should take about an hour for the dining room, 2 to 3 hours to kosher the kitchen, and another hour to clean the rest of the house. In short, about one day. So Paskins, a great posek, Rav Shlomo Aviner, Rav Chaim Scheinberg, Zichrono Levrach, who passed away just a few years ago, who was the Rav of the Yeshivas Torah Or in Mattersdorf, maybe associated more as a Haredi Rav, if you'll forgive me. You know, maybe someone said Rav Shlomo Aviner, you know, maybe he's a little bit of a Mekel. Rav Scheinberg has a very similar article, and he basically comes to the same conclusion, and he says, take it easy. Now, again, I understand and I recognize that. Exactly. I already see the heads nodding in this room. So, I understand and I respect it fully. Now, you'll say, well, how did this minhag start? After all, my mother learned it from someone who learned it from someone. So, the answer probably is, it's true. The minhag started when people lived in rooms that, in homes that are probably smaller than the smallest room in our house. And the way things, so you really had to thoroughly clean it, and cleaning the table was not just wiping it down, it involved scraping, and, you know, so realities have changed, and we live, you know, we have, you know, much more, elaborate homes, larger homes, we have more rooms, we have rooms that we very rarely, if ever, take food into, we clean the house more, we don't have rodents moving all over the place, so there are a lot of reasons why we could say there was a time in history where people really did have to, you know, really go crazy to make sure that there was no chametz lying around, or else what would that possibly contaminate in the kitchen? But today we don't have to be as concerned. So the bottom line is, in fact, one does not need to thoroughly clean every room in the entire house before Pesach. Myth. Eliyahu HaNavi visits the Seder and takes a sip of wine for the kosher Eliyahu. This one's going to hurt. If anybody wants to step out, I'll give you a minute. I'm glad there are no kids in the room. You know, we should just keep this here among us. Let's not ruin it for the kids. So the source for the custom of placing a fifth cup, we're not talking about Eliyahu. Let's just talk about the concept of a kosher Eliyahu, which we all have at our Siddurim, I imagine. There are certain communities in Israel that don't have, the Temani community doesn't have a kosher Eliyahu, but the bottom line is there is a source for this. But how old is the source? So you will not find the source in the Gemara, in the Rishonim, in the Torah, in Shulchan Aruch. The earliest source, it's fairly old. It comes from the Talmud of the Ma'aril. It's about 400 plus years old. I couldn't even find the sefer, but I did find an excerpt online. So I actually took a picture off my computer screen, so it's a little blurry. It says, "V'hinei ra'isi yesh b'nei adam b'leilei Pesach shemozgin kos miyusar ma'midin al ha'shulchan." There are those who have a custom to place an extra kos on the table, and they say, "Miyuchad." Okay, could be either one, but okay, an extra or a designated one. V'omrin yesh shezeh kos l'Eliyahu HaNavi. This is Eliyahu's kos. V'lo yadati me'ayin zeh tam. Where'd they get this from? The nearer the time yotze mihacha, the reason it's from here. Shem yavol yahu, but a navi below Pesach kashon mekavim mechakim lo zeh halayla v'tzarch gam hulakos. We hope Eliyahu navi come, especially during the month of Geula, the night of Mitzvah. Wouldn't that be great if Mashiach came on Pesach? So he'll also need a cup. Afilu anim Yisrael lo yifchulo metali kosos. Even a poor person. So Eliyahu navi is going to come to the house. V'ilo chazi kos. So he's not going to find. We're going to have to deal with it. V'dilma yidna meseder shel Pesach. Maybe what? So maybe he won't come, or it'll take away from something else. So therefore, this custom evolved. Very interesting. Doesn't sound all that different than the way we have, you know, thought about this idea of Eliyahu coming to the Seder anyway. But this idea of Eliyahu coming to the Seder and sipping from the wine and all this. So I suspect that it may have been fueled by several important factors. Number one, there's a custom, coincidentally, to open the door when saying Shu'al Chamasach. I say coincidentally because it's not necessarily linked with the Kosher Eliyahu, although in some homes, mine included, we sing Eliyahu HaNavi beforehand, which just, I think, adds to this myth more. And I'm not going to stop doing it. That's the way I was raised. I hope my children will carry on the custom. But it just, it creates confusion. We're opening the door. You sing Eliyahu, so what are you saying? You're saying Eliyahu HaNavi's coming, just like he comes to a bris. Now, you remember 7 weeks ago we spoke about the idea of having a bris in shul. The idea that Eliyahu HaNavi comes to a bris, that's not a myth. There's actually a real tradition for that. But Eliyahu coming to the Pesach Seder, we don't have a tradition for that. But given the connection that we have between Pesach and Bris, there are numerous connections, so maybe that also helps sort of, you know, fuel this myth along. It should be noted, I have to note this, that there are numerous later sources, particularly among the Sifrei Chassidus, which state explicitly that Eliyahu HaNavi visits the Seder. So this is not something that, you know, some child just made up. This is something that is found in Sfarim. However, this is the best. Oh, that should say fact. There are no early sources which indicate that Eliyahu HaNavi visits the Seder. And certainly, sipping from the wine, you know, that's probably just a way to keep kids up. And that there is a tradition for. There's a tradition from the Tanaim that we do things to keep kids up at the Seder. Things that are far more wackier than that. And I know that I can remember, and it's some of the most, you know, special memories as a child of just looking and convincing myself, you know, that the wine was going down a little bit. That's a very exciting childhood memory, and one that I don't regret having, even now that I know that Eliyahu HaNavi probably is not in my state of drinking anymore. Of all the nights of the year, it is most desirable to try and remain awake and study Torah in the night of Shavuos. This is my favorite myth of the night, I should just say. All the nights of the year, it is the most desirable to try and remain awake to study Torah in the night of Shavuos. Now, if you go online and you Google, as I did, as we'll see in a moment, Tikkun Lel Shavuos, the following comes up. And I could have kept going, and these are just probably from the last couple of years alone. I even found our shuls up there, somewhere out there in cyberspace. You have every shul and yeshiva and JCC, and it's beautiful. And it's beautiful. I'm not here to discourage it. It's, look how colorful that looks. Look how beautiful that looks. That's wonderful. People getting together, offering quality Torah programs on the night of Shavuos. That's a very, very beautiful thing. However, let's just trace the source. In the Mishnah, we don't find any source for this. In the Gemara, we don't find a source. In the Rishon, we don't find a source. In the Torah and Shulchan Aruch, we don't find a source. The Magen Avraham tells us, Isa b'Zohar. It says in the Zohar, Sir Chassidim Arishonim. The earlier Chassidim, and it's not clear, depends on when the Zohar was written, was a subject of great debate, you know, which point in history this would be referring to. It could potentially be relatively late in history. Hayun Urim Kol HaLayla V'Oskim B'Torah. People would stay up learning. Kvar Nagu Rov HaLomdim Lasos Kein. And it has become the custom that Lomdim do this. Now, far be it for me to tell anybody here that you're not a Lomade. I don't know who qualifies, who doesn't. When I think of Lomdim, so this is a picture that comes to mind. It's a beautiful picture. That's Lomdim. So, certainly doesn't say anything about having everybody in the community come out and having barbecues and sushi and pizza. Now, so what's the big deal, Rabbi? Well, you know, so what? So, are you really telling us to stay home the night of Shavuos? The answer is no. But here's what I think people should know. There is a very early source. It comes from a Tosefta. This is from the Tanaim. These are the earliest rabbinic writings that exist. This is from the time of the Mishnah. Chayev Adam Lasok Behilchos HaPesach Kol HaLayla. On the night of the Pesach Seder, a person is supposed to engage in the mitzvah of the study of Torah, the laws of Pesach, all night. It says in Shulchan Aruch, Chayev Adam Lasok Behilchos HaPesach B'Yisiyas Mitzrayim U'Lesaper B'Nisim Minaflo Sh'asok HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Avaseinu Ad She'Tach Tafenu Shein, until a person is completely overwhelmed by sleep. When a person falls asleep literally at the table, so then they're done. Actually, according to some, you're literally done. Meaning, even if you wake up, that's it. You have fulfilled your obligation. Once you fall asleep, you're out. That's the way it works. Interesting shita and a very nice explanation for it beyond our discussion this evening. But that's what it says in our earliest sources, and that's what it says in our code of law. This is what it says in Shulchan Aruch. Yet for many of us, what happens? You know, chad gadya, and then good night. And clean up the table, good night. See, I mean, you know, every shul in Teaneck and Bergenfield and the surrounding areas has a Vasikin Minyan on the morning of Shavuos. And, you know, and there are numerous, and the yeshivas have as well. So there are plenty of places where there are, thankfully, tens, maybe hundreds of people who stay up the night of Shavuos, which is a beautiful thing. I don't want to discourage it. But do we have, I don't know, do we have a Vasikin Minyan? We tried. So there it is. Okay, so there it is. So, I can't explain it. I can't explain it, but the fact of the matter is, of all the nights of the year, the night of the Pesach Seder would be the most desirable time to remain awake all night involved in the mitzvah of the study of Torah first. And again, so I'm not suggesting that we suspend Tikkun Lel Shavuos programming until further notice, until we can get a minyan. No. But it is important. It is important to know why we do things. And there is a medrash that says what?
About staying up on Shavuos. We fell asleep. They didn't fall asleep before getting to one. Then we rectified
The Medrash does not say that that's why we stay up. The Medrash just tells us that they slept late on the morning of Maimon Har Sinai. The Medrash does not tell us, therefore, we should stay up. The Magen Avraham, the Mishnah Berurah brings down, maybe that's the reason why we stay up all night long, as a way to be metaken that chet. But the Medrash does not say that we have a custom to do it. The Magen Avraham is our earliest written source, and he's quoting again, I'm sorry, Magen Avraham is quoting the Zohar, that the Chassidim Mishonim used to do this. In order to fulfill the mitzvah of Mishloach Manos, one must send at least two foods which have two different brachos. Raise your hand if you heard this one. Okay. We're going to take care of this once and for all. I have tried. But we're going to settle this now. There's no controversy about this. There are no two opinions. There's nothing to it. It just never was, never will be. Where does it come from? I'll tell you, it's very clear where it comes from. It does say in Shulchan Aruch, it's actually based on a Gemara, forgive me for not quoting, Chayiv l'shloach l'chaveiro, a person is obligated to send to his friend, Shtei manos basar, oshel minei ochlin, a person has to send two different types of meat, or different types of foods. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, u'mishloach manos ishlereyeyu. Manos doesn't just mean two of the same, but it's understood by Chazal, mean two different types, meaning two different types of food, Ishlu. So we have to give Mishloach Manos to one person, at least one person, and two different types, Shtei Manos Le'ishachad. Now, already, for those who are paying attention, you see in the Shulchan Aruch very clearly, they don't need two brachos, because it's there, two different types of meat. So what two different types of meat means, okay, that's a good question. It probably doesn't mean hamburger meatloaf. Probably doesn't mean that. But we could talk about that. But one thing's clear. You can come up with any two types of meat you want, the bracha is the same. You can say, where in Shulchan Aruch does it say that you don't need two different foods with two different brachas? That's not fair. It doesn't say anywhere that you do, and clearly here it says don't. I mean, this types. In fact, over here from the Sefer Elicha Shlomo, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, he says shnei chalokim mimin echad hachokim mitamam, two different parts of the same type which taste differently. So for example, like the top and the bottom of chicken, chashuvim k'shtei manos, says Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, that's like already two manos. Now he's not addressing the question over here, the bracha. It's not even addressed in the question of Halicha Shlomo. He doesn't bring it up because mehechates, why would you ever think you need to have two different brachos? So he doesn't address it, but he's pointing out that the top and the bottom of the chicken, that's already considered like two different manos, and that's fine. And even though he points out you need two different types, he says, in my opinion, when you have two different tastes, and you know, we have a lot of people out there who prefer, I like the top, I like the bottom. So that's already considered two different types. He says also for the purpose of Bora and Shabbos, we can consider that as well. All my years parenting, I always, you know, ask my kids, so what'd you learn in school? And with the exception maybe of 1 or 2 years, they're always learning it, always from first grade and up. You know, two different brachos. It doesn't hurt. I mean, and you know, many of us give and receive Mishloach Manos, which have many more than two brachos. It doesn't hurt at all, but it's not required. And I also believe that that's where this myth came from. Because generally when we think about minim, of foods, so we think in terms of brachos. And actually, you know, we can actually sort of justify this myth in the sense that it may just be easier for people who are not so knowledgeable in different types. So then, once it's a different bracha, you know for sure it's a different type, it's a different min. But in this, in the context of this halach, Mishloach Manos, definitely you have to give two different types of foods, two portions is not sufficient. So the fact is that when fulfilling the mitzvah of Mishloach Manos, one may send two different foods with the same bracha. The next myth, one must be able to see the stars through the schach on a sukkah. Shulchan Aruch says, derech hasichoch lios kal. And when we cover a sukkah, it should be light. Kedesh yirmi menu akochavim agdolim, so that you should be able to see the stars, the large stars. Ha'yisam uva kimin bayis, if it's very thick, like a house. Afal pisheinu kochavim nirim esocha ksheira. Even if though you can't see the stars, it's good. Now, clearly from the Shulchan Aruch, you see that it's preferable that you should be able to see the stars, without a doubt. The Mishnah Berurah says, the Daki Moshe, that's the Ramaz, Perishan, the Tor, quotes from the Ma'aril, the mutu l'sachek ha'sukkah av harbe, the yefshah shalai yirbo kochavim. The Mishnah Berurah quotes from the Ramah, not in Shulchan Aruch, but on the Torah, that you can actually use a lot of schach, even though you can't see the stars. even though at the nighttime you don't see the stars, but yom ikachod mistakim bekama makomas. During the day, some light shines in, and that's sufficient. Vayim b'sefer b'kiri Yaakov damekel kavasei lo hifsid. If you want to be makel, that's okay. But prad heichus yesh al chush demiyase aschach dak yosef. Especially if you're concerned that if you make it too light, so the wind's going to blow it, and it's going to be bothersome to people, and things are going to be falling in. So the bottom line is, there's certainly no reason why you can't make thick schach, as long as it's not so thick that it's rainproof. That could be a problem. But the fact is that one need not be able to see the stars through the schach, although it may be preferable. And our final myth of the evening. When greeting somebody with a black velvet yarmulke, you should say to him, good Shabbos. But when greeting somebody with a kippah suga, you should offer Shabbat Shalom. Now, this is definitely a myth that I can't help but sort of default into naturally. I've been spotted probably many times by people sitting here. You have a Friday night. You know, person comes over. I know his preference. I'm like, good Shabbos. I'm like, Shabbat Shalom. And if a guy comes in, he's coming in off the street. I've never seen him before. So I'm going to quickly just size him up and say, is this a good Shabbos guy? Or is this a Shabbat Shalom guy? But let's just talk about this.
Shabbat Shalom is always correct.
I agree. Shabbat Shalom is always correct. So let's see. This is not, there's something to this. It says in Parshas Vayakel, we'll read in a few weeks from now, that Moshe gathers the people together and he teaches them about Shabbos. You cannot do malacha on Shabbos. And then it says, that you should not kindle a flame, light a fire in any of your dwellings on Shabbos. That's what it says in the Torah. In the Sefer Imre Baruch, or Baruch Simon, in his Sefer on Sefer Shemos, he quotes in the Shalah HaKadosh, who says beautifully on this pasuk, Lo Savaru Esh B'chom HaShvo Seichem, that this is a remez to the Esh of Machlokes. Fire means fire, of course, but it's also a metaphor which is symbolic of fighting. And therefore we have to be very careful always, but especially on Shabbos, not to what? Not to light fires of Machlokes. There is a tradition we have that the fires of Gehenim, whatever that means, because Gehenim is probably not real fires, but the fires of Gehenim are turned off on Shabbos. Shabbos is a day which there is no fire, there's no machlokes, and therefore, the Shalom recommends that we really try to be very careful. So says Rav Simon, you have to be very careful, especially in shuls. A lot of people get together in shul on Shabbos, and shul is a place which is a potential, obviously, for a lot of shalom, a lot of peace and harmony, but also sometimes there's a potential for fighting, especially among men who are sometimes fighting over kibbudim. Thankfully, it doesn't happen often, certainly not in a very public way. I actually do have one memory as a child. I must have been very young, but I still remember it, so it really does make a roshem of two men who got in a fight in shul on Shabbos. It was an awful sight to see, but you can definitely see why something like that can happen on a Shabbos, perhaps even more likely that it would happen on Shabbos than, let's say, on a Tuesday morning when people are in and out and coming and going and running. The Ramah says, V'noagim lomer, there is a custom to say, V'hu rachum, when we start Ma'ariv Motzei Shabbos, slowly, Barichas Noam. So instead of saying, V'hu rachum, right? Say a little slower. V'hu rachum, and in fact, some have a special niggin that goes along with that, and we have people in the shul, not everybody, who try to preserve that custom. Says Ramah, K'dei lahosif mechol al kodesh. We don't want to give the impression we're running out of Shabbos. We take it slowly. So we extend the V'hu rachum. The Aruch HaShulchan says, another idea. Fascinating idea, that the reason is because we know that when we say Maariv, when Shabbos ends, so we should be sensitive to the fact that the Neshamos in Gehenim, so that's it, the week begins again. The Menucha of Shabbos ends. And so therefore we may be running, you know, to the movies, but we should be concerned and sensitive to the Neshamos in Gehenim that they have to return to the fires, so to speak, of Gehenim. Whatever this means, I don't know. But it's a beautiful example of the sort of sensitivity that we should have, not only for people around us, but for the entire universe, those who are living and those who are no longer living. That there's something about the peace, the tranquility, the serenity of Shabbos, which we should want to preserve not only for ourselves, but for the others as well. The Shalah also says, this is quoted by the Be'er Hetev in Hilchos Shabbos, Adam mevaker lechaveru b'Shabbos Shachris, when a person goes to see his friend on Shabbos morning, vitzim, lo yomar lo kederach shomer b'chol tzafra taver. You shouldn't say like you say during the week, hey, good morning. Rak yomar lo Shabbat Shalom, o Shabbat Tov, also known as Good Shabbos. L'kayim, in order to fulfill Zachar's Yom HaShabbos HaKadosh. After all, when I go ahead and I mention Shabbos in my greeting, it's a double mitzvah. I'm greeting another person, and I'm also chopping in another what? Another mitzvah of Zachir Shabbos. Rabbi Bleich, in an article, maybe his sefer, he has a book all on brain death. So he tells over there how his mother was very, very ill, and in the last days of her life, he was sitting at her bedside, and then she passed away moments after Shabbos began. And the last words on her lips, right before she passed away, were a good Shabbos. And he cited the position of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who says that when a person says good Shabbos, they fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush. Just by saying those words, good Shabbos, you fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush. That's a Zachar Yom HaShabbos HaKadosh. And I believe, if I remember correctly, in the context, the point he was making is you never know, a couple of other minutes of life, what that could do. A person is able to fulfill another mitzvah of Kiddush on Shabbos just by saying those words, good Shabbos. So Rabbi Simon quotes, Ube Pashtus, Kavanas HaShalot, Shetzorach Lahazki Yom HaShabbos, Lachaim Zachar Yom HaShabbos. Pashtus, what he means is, the Kshaomer Boker Tov, when you say good morning in a mazker, it's Yom HaShabbos. You're not saying good Shabbos. That's what we say any other morning in the week. Ulam afimasha is bar atosh Shabbos hu yom shel shalom. We're saying that Shabbos is a day of peace. Sheyesh lesrachik bo min akas b'machlokes b'tachlus arichuk. We should really try to distance ourselves from anger and machlokes. So he says, Irani Rab Binyamin Yudin Shlita. So Rabbi Simon quotes Rabbi Yudin sheyitakein shegami tamze yeinin miyuchad lomar. Shabbat Shalom lahadgish nekudezu. That maybe it's better to say Shabbat Shalom than even good Shabbos. So, we'll talk about Chag Sameach another time. Chag Sameach is another discussion. So, hold on one second. So, the bottom line is, you could continue to say good Shabbos, you could say Shabbat Shalom, but I guess maybe it's a sort of a cultural thing, a social thing. You know, it happens to be that many, many people in Israel, and I guess people who have made their way over directly, indirectly here, so they that's the way they were raised. They say Shabbat Shalom. And people who were raised perhaps in more traditional Ashkenazi communities and came over from Europe, so in their family they say good Shabbos, and both of them are fine, and both of them are good. Whether you say Shabbat Shalom or good Shabbos, it's nice to remember this idea. It's a beautiful idea. That when we say Shabbat Shalom, we have the added benefit not only of saying a Shabbos greeting, which is appropriate for Shabbos, because it incorporates the word Shabbos, and therefore we fulfill a mitzvah of Zachar Shabbos Shabbos Akadosho, but we're also able to highlight the special nature of Shabbos by pointing out that Shabbos should be a day of Shalom, it should be a day of peace. So the fact is, when greeting anyone on Shabbat, you should extend a good Shabbos or a Shabbat Shalom, but maybe Shabbat Shalom is a little better. There's actually a guy, maybe some of you know him, because he davens here sometimes, who says Shabbos Shalom. I guess he's trying to unite all of Klal Yisrael. David, what did you want to add?
That's exactly what we were
talking about. Oh, okay. Shabbat Shalom. So that's another way to maybe satisfy all Shitot. There you go. Next week, we will talk about new food for thought, mealtime myths. Thank you again.